This is Chris Vatnet. You are listening to Toilet of Hell, the best podcast in the world.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Sadate, you're listening to the Toilet of Hell radio show. I'm Joe Thrash, and kill with me, I've got 365 days of horror and briticide. How's it going, fellas?
Oh, it's going good.
We want to try that again?
Yeah.
How's it going, fellas? Oh, come on, quit doing this to me. You can't do this to me every time.
Oh, Joe, it is going so well. I'm so glad to be here, okay?
Okay. You can't just abandon me like that. Extremely nervous.
You get triggered, if you will.
Extremely triggered. We can talk about that either in a future episode or we'll see about that. Boy, fellas, we got a great show today. We've got Chris from Vatnet Vishkar. Is that how you pronounce it? We'll get him to tell us how wrong I am when he comes on in a few minutes. So we're going to learn a little bit about New Hampshire metal, man. It's, from what I understand, it's the hardest of metals. Diamond hard, man.
It's the live free or die of metal.
I will tell you that they just shortened their name to Vatnet, so that might help you out a bit.
I'm aware. I'm just trying to make the people listening somewhat familiar, because that's a fairly recent change, and they might not be familiar with that.
Yeah, well, you got to do what you got to do. But if it helps, if it makes you happy.
Now they know, and knowing is half the battle.
Yeah.
Go, Joe. That's me. So, yeah. There were things that happened in the world of metal, and I guess we could talk about it. Only poser shit, though. Poser edition only.
If you're going to twist my arm about it, sure. Are we going to talk about what we got going on?
I don't know, man. Did we talk about this on the show? I got to see Morbid Angel and Suffocation and Revocation on their tour recently.
How was that?
It was good. They were playing Austin, and I didn't get to go because my asshole friend decided that he really needed to get married instead of letting me go see the show on that particular date. So I went to Houston and got to check it out. For some reason, this show was held at a House of Blues, which I'd never been to one before. Have you fellas?
I've been to one in Boston.
Yeah, there's one in Boston.
This venue is way too, number one, big. Number two, fancy for this particular show. I'm going to guess maybe about 200-300 people in audience, and I think it fit maybe 1,000. So that's an odd choice. Why would a band do that?
Yeah. It's a little awkward. I've had that happen where you get a really big venue, and I think it's just an overestimation of people who are going to be in attendance by their promoter. So it happens, and you go to these huge venues. But hey, you got some standing room, which is a rarity and should be appreciated.
Plenty of standing room. Also, I didn't realize that I had the option of buying VIP tickets, which apparently would give me a seated table in the middle of the room. which, I mean, like, that makes sense if you're seeing, like, I don't know, fucking John Mayer or something like that, where you want to chill out and have a place to sit and not stand in your flip-flops all night long. But with this, it was just an awkward cross section of people. Like one guy was, I'm pretty sure he was wearing a top hat. That might have been Brett Stevens sitting there, like at his table, drinking a bottle of water, like while people around him, like in front of him, are moshing.
he snapped his fingers and went, "Waiter, bring me your finest tendies."
Yeah, that was the thing. People were eating tendies all over this place. I'm not joking. There was a kitchen that only served, from what I can tell, French fries and tendies. I watched some kids who must have been like, I don't know, 16 in front of me. Like, they were so excited to see these bands, and they were so excited to eat these tendies that looked like fucking garbage.
I bet they were just brown and over-fried and in like one of those fucking checker patterned, like, red and white paper baskets, all absorbing the grease.
It's like you were right there with me, man.
I think I might have been.
And they just taste like the oil they were fried in.
Oh, yeah. There was no actual meat on these things. It was just, like, little clumps of brown fried shit.
Skin.
the perfect side dish to watch death metal.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, this tour is notable in that, you know, they kicked David Vincent to the curb, and he's busy pretending that he's a country man now, talking with a fake southern drawl, too. It's awesome. And they got Steve Tucker back on this particular tour. They were only playing Steve Tucker material, which I got to say was pretty disappointing when I heard about that, because I had never had the chance to see Morbid Angel before, and the Vincent material is by far my favorite. But it was pretty cool watching this, and it was wild watching Trey like pull off the weird shit that he plays live. So I was glad I got to go. My lady especially enjoyed seeing Revocation, because David Davidson is just like, he's a fucking guitar hero. Like, he was pulling off all kinds of crazy moves, and she was, you know, she's not a big death metal fan by any stretch, so she enjoyed watching him be Chuck Berry on stage.
Yeah, you know, our boys from Boston, they really shred it up, but I don't think I've ever had the chance to see them live. Do they are they as technically proficient live as they are on their albums? I mean, do they keep it going?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, this is the second time that I'd seen Revocation, and I have to say their material recorded is not especially exciting to me. Seeing them live, though, it makes everything work. Like, it's just a great experience. So if you have the opportunity at some point in the future, definitely go check that shit out, because it's
awesome. Oh, yeah,
awesome.
Definitely will.
Yeah. Anyway, what are your metal-related stories from the week?
Well, I've heard that Ozfest may be coming back.
Whoa!
I especially like the way we kind of almost found out about that. It's like Ozzy could have potentially had a senior moment and very publicly asked Zakk Wylde if, hey, did you want to do this? And he just got confused and didn't find his text messages the way he was supposed to.
Well, this was done on his Instagram, right?
I don't know. It's so, on Facebook as well, so.
So maybe Ozzy was just looking at his phone and just yelled into it, Zakk, you want to play Ozfest?
Yeah, he just hit his speech recognition software and started screaming in it in the middle of a Dunkin' Donuts.
That's awesome. Well, can your jitterbug, like, do speech recognition software?
My jitterbug?
Yeah. There's no way Ozzy has an iPhone. He's not cognitively with it enough to be able to punch the buttons.
Maybe he was, I think he was in that Samsung commercial with Justin Bieber back in one of those Super Bowls, so maybe they're still setting him up with some free swag, so I don't know. Maybe he's trying it on the Galaxy S50 or whatever they're up to at this point.
I would pay $10 to watch Ozzy try to operate a telephone for like 5 minutes.
Well, the thing is, with this post, there is also credit to the photo of him and Zakk Wylde. I don't think Ozzy's quite with it enough to have the sense to give someone photo credit. So I'm going to guess it wasn't him.
I better give Getty Images the due.
Siri, credit Getty Images, you fucking thing.
Alexa.
Sweet. So, I've heard that there might be chances of rumors, of whispers, of possibilities of this Ozfest being something worthwhile. And why would it be worthwhile for us, 365?
Well, is it the Ozfest Instagram account, or is it Ozzy's Instagram account that's doing this?
It's Ozfest, the Ozfest Instagram, or however that URL structure works, yeah.
So anyway, this Ozfest Instagram is posting old throwback pictures of, like, Marilyn Manson and, like, Walls of Jericho, and an old picture of the former lead singer, Dave, I think Williams was his name, of Drowning Pool. And people are assuming that this is some sort of slightly coded language to say that Ozfest is coming back and they're going to have these bands on it.
I'm just saying, man, now's the time to go back to your roots and rediscover what made you you. And in the case of Ozfest, it's nu metal, baby. I had a couple of the first Ozfest compilation CDs. They were awesome, man. Like, shit, there was, like, Coal Chamber.
Puya.
Yeah, Puya. There was Who is that? Biohazard was on it, and the, like the worst Aussie songs, like Perry Mason.
Didn't MTV have like a reality show years and years ago, Battle for Ozfest, and they used like the Dima Borgir song as the main opener?
Wait, really? I have never heard of this in my life.
Oh yeah, I remember A Dozen Furies won, and it was funny because
they're the Alaskan band, right?
No,
okay.
That's 36 Crazy Fists.
Yeah, there are too many Furies and Crazy Fists.
But the thing with A Dozen Furies was that the guitarist who was on the show, like trying to get onto Ozfest, was already on Ozfest. Was already on Ozfest previously, under the band Unloco. So it was kind of a weird thing for people in the nu metal know, like I was.
If you so this was A Dozen Furies.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you take a five finger death punch and you multiply it by 36 Crazy Fists, it should be about a dozen Furies,
give or take. That sounds give or take.
See, the thing is with these Instagram posts, like, nothing against Walls of Jericho, but I don't think the Ozfest crowd is really clamoring to see them, so I don't see the point in being like, hey guys, Walls of Jericho's coming, oh, and Marilyn Manson.
I would pay to see the reanimated corpse of Dave Williams' front drowning pool. Is that what they're offering?
More people would see Drowning Pool then than they do now.
Heyo. For some reason, I don't know if it was you and I that were talking or if I was maybe talking with Debbie, but I believe they're on their fourth vocalist now.
I think it's about right. They had like the guy from Soil, I think, doing vocals at one point too.
So, I mean, Drowning Pool, still a thing. They were a DFW band. I remember when they came out, they were a huge, you know, where I was growing up. You heard them bodies hitting the floor all the time. Their other one that was like, I don't care about anyone else but me. I thought that was pretty a good one, you know?
You are a sinner!
And then Bodies Hit the Floor was taken off radio after 9/11.
Shit, right. Really? Oh, they had that list of bands that or songs that couldn't be played on. Who made that list? Who was that?
I think, let's take a second to Google it. Let's see if we can find it.
I recall, like, I think System of a Down was also on there. I remember Power Man 5000 was going to release their, like, follow-up album to Tonight the Stars Revolt, like, that week or, like, the week after. And the first single for that album was, like, Bombshell. And everyone went, whoa, can't have bombs. And, like, the album got shelved for a while, and that was pretty much the end of Power Man 5000.
Man, Bush put out, like, a record, like, the week of 9/11 that was something about, like, a plane out of control. That was one of the things that got knocked off, too.
And Slayer's God Hates Us All had the four crosses on the album cover, and people went, oh, those are airplanes.
Didn't God Hates Us All get released the same day?
I think
strangely enough.
Either the same day or the same week, something like that.
Yeah, so, something like that.
So this was the 2001 Clear Channel Memorandum. The 2001 Clear Channel Memorandum. This was a document distributed by Clear Channel, the company that, you know, used to own pretty much like every radio station across the U.S. I believe that it's now become something like iHeartRadio. But it was released shortly after the 9/11 attacks, and it was distributed to all the radio stations they owned. And it was a list of songs that they termed lyrically questionable. Things that they were... It was 165 suggestions, songs suggesting that you don't play on your station. The thing is fucking crazy, man. It had 7 AC/DC songs. And I mean, Shot Down in Flames makes sense. Whereas Dirty Deeds Done Cheap does not make sense to me, but what the fuck do I know, you know?
To be fair, all those AC/DC songs are just the same song anyway.
That is absolutely true, and people will get really mad at you if you say that.
Yeah, good. Maybe Clear Channel was just finally using a good excuse to get AC/DC off the fucking radio.
You know, that would be the first good thing Clear Channel ever did.
Good and the last.
But I mean, like, you had shit like the Beastie Boys, you couldn't play Sabotage or Sure Shot. Black Sabbath, Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, and War Pigs. No go. Mm. Bush, the big single that they had for like a couple of days before 9/11 happened because it was right after their release. It was called Speed Kills. So that was what killed Bush for forever. Did we talk
about...
It's
really bizarre.
Yeah, I know, man. It was super weird. I feel like I've talked about Gavin Rossdale on the show before, so I felt like I needed to include that particular tidbit. Man, like, it kind of covered everything. There was a Doors song that was not allowed to play, so good on Clear Channel for not making me hear that shit. But some of this stuff makes no sense, like Santa Monica by Everclear. Like, I'm sure you guys have heard that song because it was all over radio, like, when we were kids.
Watch the world die. Isn't that the line?
Oh,
swing out past the breakers and watch
my
the world die.
My daddy gave me a name.
Good point. Let's see. Break Stuff by Limp Bizkit on the list, unfortunately. That is uncool, man. Very uncool.
Well, while we're on the subject of this, I remember there was one of the films that Michael Moore did. I think it was Fahrenheit 9/11. And he went to go interview troops in... I don't remember if it was Iraq or Afghanistan. I'm going to assume it was Iraq. My memory fails me. He was interviewing the troops, and pretty much what he was trying to do in the film is show that the troops were just a bunch of yeah dude scumbags, which, you know, think what you will, they're all different people, but some of them, yeah, they're a bit questionable in their attitudes towards what they were doing. And, one of the guys was in a tank, and, he was showing Michael Moore his CD, and he was like, oh yeah, this is Drowning Pool. We play Let the Bodies Hit the Floor when we go around blowing people up, and it's really cool. I just think it's interesting that you bring up that was one of the songs that got banned because of 9/11, because in the movie Fahrenheit 9/11, that was a song that was highlighted as something some bro troops were using when they were just shooting as many people as their hearts desired.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that as well, because that song was also used in enhanced interrogation techniques.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I heard.
Yeah, so, you know, for those that didn't grow up around... you know, that particular era of war that's continued for 16 years, enhanced interrogation is torture. So there were a number of songs that, like, the U.S. military was using, like, blasting at people for days at a time to basically just break the will of these poor people that were basically captured and suspected of terrorism, and it was never proven. They never went to trial if they were terrorists or not. And some of them are still sitting in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba to this day, having never had a trial. And it's funny that, like, the music that teenage shitheads were enjoying at the time was used as actual torture here.
I remember that there's an interview with Lars Ulrich from Metallica, because Enter Sandman was one of the songs that was highlighted as one of the ones used commonly in these kinds of interrogations. And I remember Lars Ulrich saying, like, wow, I mean, that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. There's a lot of Norwegian death metal bands that they definitely should have used instead. And I remember being like a hand-wringing elitist and saying, you make black metal, you idiot!
He's right, though. Like, listening to Burzum would have been 10 times the torture of Enter the Sandman. But yeah, there was Let the Bodies Hit the Floor. There was Enter Sandman. And then, more questionably, there was shit like Raspberry Beret by Prince, which is just a legitimately great song. They did use Deicide, Fuck Your God, a song by them, and Marilyn Manson.
And they used Meshuggah, too.
I know that they used the Meow Mix theme song, which is pretty fucking great. They used the Barney and Friends theme song. Christina Aguilera was another one as well.
And I wish the Meshuggah song...
And Dope, a band that you and I have made fun of many, many times on this show. They have the pederast guitar player, Dope.
They did. He's not in the band anymore, to be fair.
Until they send me the cease and desist, I'm not stopping.
Never
well,
forget.
Then we also might as well bring up that their last record sold more than All That Remains. It's always worth bringing that up.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's rough, man.
So, again, I lost the plot, as I generally do, but Ozzfest is coming back, and they're bringing back one of the most notorious new metal bands of all time.
Splendid. Any other major festivals? Anything worth mentioning? Any big circuits we got going on this summer?
I believe that there's some kind of laughter going on during the summer.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Slaughter. Slaughter. I can't fucking read.
Oh, I thought it was Summer's Laughter Tour.
I could be wrong, and I probably should have asked this when we had Trevor on the show, but I think that the Black Dahlia Murder does Summer Slaughter, like, literally every year.
It must be Trevor in the background.
Yes, those death metal growls are pugs who will not get away from my feet to fight. They just fight all the time, man. Sorry about that. But the Black Dahlia Murder is doing something a little special this year. They are playing... is it Nocturne?
It's Nocturnal.
Nocturnal. Good, I can edit that out so I don't sound like a fucking asshole. They're going to be playing Nocturnal in its entirety on the tour. Do you guys know who else is on there? Because I feel like I heard that maybe Rings of Saturn was going to be there as well.
Last I heard they were going to be there. We'll see if they actually play.
I mean, like, hitting space, the space bar on your MacBook counts as playing.
Yeah, good enough.
Yeah,
but along with Black Dahlia Murder, it's going to be like Dying Fetus, The Faceless, maybe, Oceano, Slaughter to Prevail, Origin, and a whole bunch of others.
I was going to ask if the Faceless were planning on not showing up to this one, which is all they ever do.
They're going to bail. Like, I'll put $5 on that. They're going to bail.
Yeah, and they're going to blame everybody else except the person you ask. but I think it's interesting that they're playing Nocturnal. Nocturnal happens to be one of my favorites by them, and it's interesting because it was kind of a pivotal time for Black Dahlia Murder, because this was when this was their last album with their previous lead guitarist, who I can't recall the name of at the time, but after which they had switched over to Ryan Knight, who was formerly in Arsis, as their guitarist. And at that point, they had a bit more of a melodic death metal sound. They really kind of embraced that technical sort of approach to death metal. So a lot of people, it's kind of like the Metallica Black Album thing with some people. Like, they say this was when they stopped being good, started being good, et cetera, based on the guitarist move.
Sellouts.
Yeah, right.
Well, the reason why they're playing Nocturnals is it's the 10-year anniversary of the album coming out.
Oh,
okay.
That makes more sense then.
Yeah.
I don't know. Also, it's a shame that you have to wait for, like, an anniversary, though. Like, I think bands should be able to play, like, a full album whenever they feel like it, you know?
I guess that was just the concept I was going off of. They just did it because they wanted to. But wow, that thing came out 10 years ago. That's really making me feel old.
Ha! You're all gonna die.
Existential dread once again.
Time's a flat circle.
But I think it's interesting that they took Ryan Knight, and then after Ryan Knight left the band, which I think was some point last year, it announced his departure, they took on Brandon Ellis, which is a strange trend. And next time you get Trevor on the show, maybe you can ask him what this is about. But it seems like Arsis is kind of the dugout bench for Black Dahlia Murder guitarists, and I'm sure whoever they have right now is going to be their next one.
It's like the form system.
That's right. It's what I was telling Jordan earlier, is that it's like the Arsis is the American Hockey League to Black Dahlia Murder's NHL. They just have their minor leagues Hartford, going on there.
The Hartford Wolfpack to the New York Rangers.
Exactly.
Well, what are some albums that you'd like to hear front to back from some bands?
I want to hear Dope Smoker by Sleep.
You probably get that opportunity from time to time, I think.
Probably, yeah.
I'd like to hear Opeth do Deliverance. Yeah, excuse me, let's edit that out. I'd like to hear Opeth do Deliverance and Damnation back to back.
How long would that show be?
I don't know. I assume they take a break halfway through, you know, have it be like a real performance, but I don't know, maybe 2 hours.
When Amon Amarth released, I think it was Twilight of the Thunder God, they did a tour where the year that they released said album, they performed that album in its entirety. And it was an interesting show because Amon Amarth came out, they played that new album in its entirety. They're like, oh, we'll take a break, we'll see you guys in a bit. and then they left and took like 20 minutes, half hour, and then came back on and then performed all their big hit singles or whatever. It was interesting because there were no openers, there was no closers, it was just them, and that was how the show was set up. I've never seen anything like that before.
That'd be such an alpha move to be like, we'll be right back, and then just not come back.
You just hear the bus warm up and drive away.
We're just standing in the pit. We gotta go get a pack of cigarettes. We'll be right back, champ, I promise. I've heard that lie before.
I haven't seen a Monomarth in 20 years.
I think that's true.
I would have loved to, getting back to Morbid Angel. I would have loved to just hear Domination front to back. Like that one's my jam. It's my Jimmy jam.
Getting back to Morbid Angel, didn't David Vincent start a new band and call it like Ain't I Morbid or something stupid?
Am I Morbid? Yeah. I honestly don't know how that's gonna work while he's still trying to pretend to be Waylon Jennings. And I suspect, based on the interactions that Trey's mom has had with him on Facebook, that there might be some concerns over permissions to actually play these songs live.
I don't know why we haven't done a show on Trey's mom yelling at him.
Maybe I swear to God we did. I don't.
Yeah.
Did we do that? Oh, okay.
I think before you joined.
Ah, that's right.
If you want to pretend to be Trey's mom right now, like, by all means, go for it.
David! Fuck off, you loser!
I don't know. But
I think we need a show where you just do David Vincent, or what's this guy's name? I blank, sorry.
Joey.
David Vincent.
Whose mom is this?
Joey DeMaio.
Yeah, I'm saying you need to have a Joey mom and this mom just having a conversation back and forth for like 45 minutes.
Boy, that would be some like the stuff of just voiceover legend if I could pull that off. If I could just create two different angry mom characters and have them do an hour-long conversation, I'll get back to you guys on that one.
I think it's your holy grail.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's my breakthrough hit.
That's your homework assignment, man. Get that to us for the next episode because I'm afraid that we're almost out of time on this one. What do we want to say to put us out? What do we want to close it with?
Well, I think that everybody should check out the Summer Slaughter tour regardless. It's actually a pretty sick lineup, regardless of whether the Faceless are going to be there or not. Black Dahlia Murder are an amazing band live. Dying Fetus are as well. Say what you want about their sensibilities regarding this newest record. And
honestly, I think this new record is awesome. The name is just incredibly stupid.
Right, that's what I'm talking about. The new album's great. But I think it's going to be cool. I can't wait to go see all this stuff. And go check it out, dudes.
Who do we think is going to drop off first? Who do we think is going to drop off first? The Faceless or Rings of Saturn?
Faceless, hands down. No, it'll be Rings of Saturn, and then at the very fucking last minute, when it's especially inconvenient for everybody, that's when the Faceless will drop off.
I think you nailed it.
They should have a show where the Faceless opens for Rings of Saturn, and then that's just a show, and then nobody has to go.
It's just a blank stage, and people are standing around for 2 hours.
Eating their tendies at the table waiting.
The sound guy gets up there like, all right, we're about to start the show. I'm just going to get a pack of cigarettes.
And then he never comes back.
Yeah.
welcome back. We have joining us today Chris Alfieri of the band formerly known as Vatnet Viskar, now known simply as Vatnet. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Doing very well. Thanks for joining us today. I guess before we get into the rest of it, let's get down to the obvious question. Why the change from Vatnet Viskar to simply Vatnet?
It'd be something we were discussing for a while as a band, and like we kind of just called ourselves Vatnet kind of internally for the longest time, and then just realized it was simpler than trying to explain what our band name meant to people that were at gas stations on tour, because they always ask you, and then you're just like, oh, Vatnet Viskar, and they're like, what does that mean? And you're like, it's Swedish for this, so now it's just like Vatnet, and they say Fatnet, and we're like, yeah, that's what it is, so... and we ended up losing one of the, me and Nick were founded the band. We ended up losing Nick. So it just kind of made sense to, we lost half of the founding members. So let's just cut the name in half. Bam.
So, what caused the split with Nick?
Honestly, sorry, I'm smoking a cigar here, living the dream. honestly, I don't know. I think the road's kind of really hard on people. This industry and this kind of lifestyle is a little bit rough. As you guys know, working in the industry a little bit, there's not a lot of thanks in it. And it's just like super taxing on your personal life. So I think he just kind of ended up kind of getting fed up with that side of it. We ended up touring ridiculously too much. And I think all of us got burnt out. So, basically I think it just burnt him out the most. And it just wasn't what he wanted to do anymore. Which is kind of understandable. We all got in that spot. And when he quit, the band kind of, I don't know. I don't want to say we almost broke up, but we just needed to take like a severe, hiatus from each other and everything and kind of regroup and figure out what we wanted to do. And I mean, as far as what we were discussing, changing things around before he left it, we still did the same stuff. It just made more sense to have Casey sing now and just kind of keep it the three of us and not keep bringing more people in. Because the more people we bring in, the more people end up leaving. So, you know, who knows what it is, but the usual answer to that.
So when did Casey come in exactly?
Casey came in for Settler. We wrote and recorded Settler, and Casey was hugely instrumental in that. Nick was actually living in Austin at the time, so the majority of Settler was written with me, Casey, and Seamus in a room. And then Nick came in, and we added some stuff. We added a few songs with him. But we've always known Casey. He's always been kind of in the orbit, and he's always been about to join, but just personal stuff before... just wasn't the time yet. So basically it just worked out where we needed a bass player and Casey's kind of a multi-instrumentalist. So we were able to bring him in on bass. But as far as like recording and writing Settler, he played guitar on that as well. So just having him on board has been actually pretty excellent. And then we all knew he could sing. We tried to have him sing some parts on Settler, but it just didn't feel right at the time as far as sound. But we knew going forward, we wanted to kind of change directions and basically go for a more songwriting approach. And we just felt that his kind of more introspective lyrics, and his kind of ability to carry melodies would be, you know, a much better fit for what we wanted to do. He was in orbit forever. And finally, we just kind of all landed on the same page, which has been excellent.
You know, it's crazy. I didn't think about it until I guess right just now. But hearing the new single that you put out, I guess about a month or so back, the first thing I thought of was, you know, that sure sounds like Astronoid. It's a lot closer to at least that sound than I guess the kind of post-hardcore black metal sound that you guys had on the last couple records. And of course,
yeah,
sharing a member there, I finally put it together.
Yeah, Brett who does most of the Astronoid writing as far as the kind of the core writing for that, he recorded the first EP we did and Sky Swallower. So we've known Brett for forever. We've done tours with Astronoid. So it's kind of always been the kind of New England collective, as far as our two bands have always kind of hung out together and kind of just like had the same interests. And me and Brett go way back. So it just made sense to kind of, that's probably what you're hearing as far as the similarities, is like a lot of the same, we listen to a lot of the same music and we all kind of are in the same group of friends. So it just makes sense that pretty much everything sounds slightly similar.
Gotcha. That makes sense. So I guess the last, I could be wrong here, but the last big tour that you did, I believe it was with Taki. Is that how you pronounce it?
I think so. They said Taka, but I said Tak. So,
geez, I've been saying Take for years. I'm mispronouncing all sorts of band names.
It's these Norwegians, man. You just don't know.
Everybody, yeah, we don't pronounce American stuff properly here, so it's all the same. That's a big black metal tour, I guess. With the change in sound, do you expect to ever go out with a crew like that again?
No, although that was probably one of the best tours we ever did. That was also the tour where I personally realized that like I didn't fit in generally as far as like the typical black metal musician. And I mean, we can get into how specific and closed off that scene is, but personally, as far as me personally, I never felt like I fit in at those shows. I never felt like I fit in with that type of music. I just enjoyed it. But there's a certain level of credibility you have to prove with those people that I'm just never been interested in, you know, like showing, oh, this is my record collection, so you guys know like that I'm legit and everything. Like, it's just, it's very weird and very strange, that group. And you know, we've all read the internet and we see how specific they are with what they like and dislike. But it just got really tiring trying to prove ourselves in that scene. And it's just, I mean, I got to a point where it's just pointless, actually. Like, it was just like, it's, you know, we're getting these great tours. We went out with 1349, and then we were able to go out with like Dillinger Escape Plan. And I felt more at home and with the Dillinger Escape Plan shows than any black metal shows we ever played. As far as, you know, just hanging out with those people or walking amongst the audience and stuff, like so many times we got just yelled names at us and stuff like that, where at the end of it, you're just like, why am I doing this? When I get in the van, I don't even really listen to this type of music anymore. Like, it's just, it gets, I don't know, it just gets tiring, I guess.
You mentioned touring with, I guess, pronounced Taki now, who knew? And you touched on that you knew of their questionable and, you know, downright racist comments and actions over the years. Was there any concern touring with a band like that, just either on a personal level or like for the band as like a business?
Of course. I mean, it gets to a point where you have to kind of decide what you stand for and what you stand against. I had read their singer's host's actions. As far as like him putting swastikas on himself, I'd read why he did it. And I understood why he did it. His explanation was kind of like he wanted to remind Germany of the shittiness of what they had done in their past, which that explanation I understand. Do I agree with that sort of protest? No, definitely not. As far as them as people, they were like legit the nicest people we've ever met, which was just so weird. Because there's that disconnect between someone's public image and their private image, and how they present themselves as a person when you're walking around backstage with them or getting to sound check with them. Never once did I feel like, I don't know, I don't want to question if he actually believes what he's saying, but I think he might come from an older school of, you know, trying to provoke people for a reaction, which I just think is kind of a dead medium nowadays, but some people don't realize that yet. But as far as a business standpoint, I mean, I know people know who we are. They know my political stance and what side I've stood on. And if I had seen anything questionable on that tour specifically, I would have been the first to call it out or leave. But as far as touring with that group of people and them and Youngin and the Way were, honestly some of the nicest people we've ever toured with, which, I, like I said, was just kind of a shock. Just because, you know, Taka has definitely has that kind of stigma. But did it hurt us? No. I mean, we did really great on that tour and we got really great reaction. And I don't think that in the long term people connected our band or Youngin in the way with those statements. It's a hard line to ride. It's like in the 90s, would you tour with Marilyn Manson after Columbine? I don't know. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this goes both ways. Are you concerned now that these poor Norwegians are going to be labeled posers now for having toured with you in the past?
I don't even, like, that's the thing. I don't even know if they were aware of who we were before we jumped on the tour. It was just us jumping on was kind of last minute. There was another band that was supposed to play, and they weren't able to get on those dates. So we just kind of got an email probably about a month or two before and was like, do you guys want to do these dates? And there wasn't a lot of time for us to consider. We weren't doing anything else. I'm a huge Youngin in the Way fan. So for me, I was like, I just want to kind of tour with those dudes and get to know them, watch them every night. Which was incredible. Those dudes put on one hell of a show. And their members are, you know, as equally as leftist as I am. So it was as far as what people kind of believe, it was a good mix of different views. Although, you know, those views were never truly discussed with each other. Us and Youngin in the Way had a ton of political conversations. And our views lined up, much more than what people probably think Takas do. But there was also a language barrier with them. And I mean, most of the time they were speaking Norwegian. So it was, you know, it's hard, man. It's hard to kind of be in the black metal scene and not come in contact with somebody who was on Season of Mist or something, you know. It's just, that's where I started to get kind of uncomfortable with it all. And it's like, why am I even involved in this scene anymore when it seems to have this huge problem, where I'm getting in the van and just listening to Bruce Springsteen basically 24/7. It's like, what am I doing here at the end of the day?
Yeah, I'm constantly, and we talk about this on the show all the time, I'm constantly perplexed by black metal fans. And that everyone seems to be striving for an authenticity that doesn't really exist. And if it did, it existed almost 30 years ago, among like a couple of troubled teenagers. So
exactly.
Everyone is constantly in this reactionary, toxic mindset, trying to cull the group and see who can be in, and everybody else is, of course, out, is a poser, is not truly black metal. And I mean, how long would you say that you've been involved in black metal?
I mean, one of the first CDs I bought was a Dimmu Borgir record, which I always considered them black metal. My black metal, I mean, that was, so probably I was 14 or 15. I mean, I went through a phase where I specifically only listened to Metallica and only listened to Metallica from probably 12 to 15. I was just like, Metallica is the best band of all time, which I still think they are. But then I kind of started delving out a little bit, and I really liked the orchestration of black metal as a music. I never really thought it was cool to burn down buildings in general. I'm more of a guy that's like, if you believe in something, that's great for you, as long as it doesn't impact the person next to you, or, you know, that's good. So even the idea of burning down somebody else's church, although I understood what their point was, as far as historically speaking, it just, that wasn't why I was kind of attracted to it. When I got super into black metal was getting into Emperor and getting into Wolves in the Throne Room, and Altar of Plagues. That's kind of where I liked the atmosphere of it. And kind of, as somebody said recently, like painting a room, with an atmosphere, which I felt like black metal bands could do, much better than any other musicians that I had heard, sort of like jazz musicians. And I'm not putting black metal on the level of jazz, except for maybe The Shining. Not the bad Shining, the good Shining. but because you have to make these distinctions nowadays. But I got into it, you know, the same way any other metalhead gets into different types of metal after they discover the first type of metal that they like. But the stigmas attached to it, I didn't realize until way later, until the backlash started coming and until What's-His-Face got out of jail from burning those churches down and started making weird-ass YouTube videos. And once that started happening, it's just kind of like, again, you're just like, why am I here? What am I doing?
What's the New Hampshire metal scene like? I've only been to New Hampshire once. It was actually to play a show with a side band from the guys from Backstabbers, Inc., so super New Hampshire reference there. But we played in like the back of a restaurant, and I couldn't like really gauge what the scene was like.
Well, you just summed the scene up. It's always at the back of a restaurant. it's always at a nightclub that's not normally known for metal. Tons of deathcore, and like I'm not knocking any local New Hampshire bands, but they seem to be kind of stuck within one genre. There's not a lot of black metal bands in New Hampshire, which I kind of feel odd about because we have tons of mountains and tons of fog, you know, lots of eeriness. But it's just a scene that's dead. It used to be kind of more alive. It should be living. We're a good spot between Boston and Montreal as far as touring bands go. But not a ton of venues, not a ton of promoters willing to stick their head out. Not a ton of money put into the scene. So somebody's got to start somewhere. But as far as right now, like what you just described is basically, you know, you'll get a couple shows a month or a couple shows every few months that are just kind of like, again, back of a restaurant, back of a Chinese restaurant, something like that. But there's people that are trying to give it life, but it just, you get a little bit and then, you know, you get shut down. You get a little bit further, you get shut down. So there's been a few bands short of like Godsmack was our claim to fame. So that kind of tells you what it is.
I always assumed their vocalist is Sully, right? I just assumed that was a Boston band.
Yeah, Sully is a very Boston name.
I mean, you're both New Englanders, so you're much more familiar with this than me. But I mean, aside from New Hampshire, I mean, there are a couple of rural states there, it seems like they kind of get the short end of the stick compared to, you know, your Bostons or your, you know, your, what is it? New York? Is that a place over there?
That's not New England.
Yeah. I mean, New York's probably 4.5 hours from me. So, and then you got Portland, Maine is actually doing very well right now. But short of those two, I mean, Burlington, Vermont had a good Metal Mondays thing going for a while. But like you said, it just, if it's not between something or not a known market, I mean, the way booking agents work is they send a band up. If the band did okay and gave it a good review, then they'll try and send another band up. But if that band said, "Bill, this place sucks," then that booking agent's not going to send another band up and take a chance and miss out on a guarantee or something. Even us, I mean, we haven't played New Hampshire since 2015.
Oh, wow.
So, it's just not, I don't know, there's not a lot up here. There's just a lot of people that, you know, are more interested in drinking a beer and watching Netflix, I guess.
Live free or die for a reason.
yeah. They like to go shoot guns here, which, that's pretty much it. If you can't bring a gun to a show, then why go?
Sounds a little bit like Texas.
Have you seen people come to a show with, you know, assault rifle strapped to their back, just in case?
No, not recently, at least.
Again, like,
I don't even know if you can bring a gun. I don't know if you can bring a gun. Most venues have signs out to say, like, no firearms or whatever. But the thing about New Hampshire is walking down the street, you have to assume that everybody around you has a gun, which is kind of disconcerting at points, but as someone who doesn't have a gun.
Yeah, we've got like open carry pretty much everywhere in Texas, so people get mad if you put up a sign on your business that says, please do not bring your gun in here. It's, you know, it's enough to
set everybody.
Yeah,
and then you get the Fox News story, and,
yeah,
and that's it. You get, you know, all of a sudden they're rioting in Texas with guns.
Yeah, they just hate freedom, clearly.
Clearly. So I have to ask, because the guitar sounds on this record, or at least the one song that I've heard from this upcoming record, what are you using? What kind of equipment do you have for this?
I was using Orange for a while. Right now I'm using a Mesa Dual Rec, and I think Casey's using an Orange Rock Reverb, both through Orange Cabs. To record, we actually use AxeFX, which is kind of like a digital program that just kind of models all amps, which to me, I could like basically clone my amp into it, and it was unreal. Like probably the most insane thing I've ever used, you know, short of like crappy digital programs, because you're expecting it to be like, no, man, I can hear the difference in my amp, but then you're just like, no, I can't actually. Like it sounds exactly like my amp. So we're using that, and we're using Fender guitars now, which kind of give it kind of a more, to me, a more natural sound than the active pickups that from the EMGs, because we were using ESP before this. So we kind of changed everything around. So the riff to me in Dark Black, it sounds like a VATnet riff from before, only because I wrote it a while ago. And we just hadn't used it yet, but everybody else seems to think it's completely different. So it's always weird when you wrote it and you can't really hear it the way somebody else hears it if you've been involved in the writing process.
So when can we expect the new record? I saw you you posted to Twitter that you have the test presses now.
Yeah, we have a release date. I just can't tell you guys yet. It'll be, let's say, the end of this summer. If summer stops, in like September, October, theoretically, there'll be a full release by then. And we're definitely going to announce that probably within the next 2 weeks or so. You'll have a ton more information as far as a release date and, another song. So
that's awesome.
Should be good.
Now, yeah. One of the things we like to ask our guests on the show, is that, you know, we all know that it is incredibly difficult to make any kind of money at all with extreme metal. So what do you do to pay the bills on the side?
My wife and I actually own a small business. We own a consignment shop where we live in Concord, New Hampshire.
That's awesome. So
So we're...
What kind of stuff do you normally see come into the shop?
We do furniture and mostly women's clothes. My wife went to school for fashion and retail, so she mostly heads it up. I can take barely any credit for it whatsoever, besides kind of holding her up and, you know, watching the store when she needs me to and hanging out, basically. But it's fully her deal, which I'm super proud of her for, because we just bought it a year ago. And being a small business owner is, I would say, almost as hard as trying to make money off of music. But, you know, not having a boss, I guess, is second to none. So that's a good thing.
That is true. You've chosen difficult paths for your life, but at least free paths.
Yeah. The ones with the most resistance, I guess they say, are the most rewarding. Or maybe I think I just made that up, actually. But no, it's been good. And I also watch people's dogs every now and then for money. So if you have a dog and you live in New Hampshire, hit me up.
Has anyone ever brought in like anything specifically weird to the consignment shop, like a taxidermed animal or something like that?
No, my wife loves taxidermed animals, though, and we have like a bird that her grandfather shot hanging on our wall right here. So when she hears this, she'll go, that's not weird. But no, not really. You know, we just get a lot of people that try to bring in like dead people's clothes, and, you know, so-and-so just died, and I have like, you know, racks and racks of weird stuff. But for the most part, it's just dealing with the general public, which is probably the equivalent of dealing with black metal musicians. So yeah.
Everybody's angry all the time. Well, is there anything that you think that our listeners ought to know about this new record?
Don't judge the whole record by the one single you've heard, because pretty much every song sounds different, which has been not something I feel like VatNet has achieved in the past. And just kind of keep an eye out for more news, because we'll be releasing a track. Like I said, within the next 2 weeks, you'll hear something else and realize that, damn, that sounds completely different than the other song. So sweet.
How has the fan response been to the first single?
It's been half black metal fans that are like, what the hell is this? And half people that are on the other side that kind of match up more with us, to listen to the Deftones and other types of music, that have been like, this is awesome. So you just focus on the good, and try not read the comment sections on anything.
And it's a good life lesson.
That's pretty, yeah. That's going to be on my tombstone. Just like, don't read the comments. but it's been really great. Very supportive. And the new label we're on, New Damage, has been extremely into it. So, we've got a good team, and it's been really good, surprisingly.
So it's not a suicide silence situation where everyone hits your guts?
No, not yet. We'll see. But there's already people that hate our guts, but no, not any new ones recently, I don't think.
That's such a funny thing to get all riled up and hot and bothered about. Like, the band that I like no longer sounds like they did, so they're posers.
It's weird. Like, you know, I always think, well, you still have those, if you liked us before, you still have those first two records to listen to. And, you know, why are you so vocal about, like we have one guy that just, you know, every post we make, he writes, he does like a little sad face emoji on it. Like he hates everything we're doing now. And I'm like, you know, this guy is a kind of a black metal fan, and he's using a sad face emoji to show that he's like so tough and upset, but it's like, you're using a sad face emoji online. So I don't, you know, it's the 2017 is just so weird to me that I almost feel like I'm in like a virtual reality or something. Like, it's just, nothing's real. So I don't even take anything to heart anymore. It's just like, well, whatever, by next week, everybody will forget about this, because so-and-so will say something else stupid on Twitter and we'll be good to go. So yeah.
All my true black metal fans, hit that sad react emoji.
Exactly.
Lyrically, you said this record is going to be a little bit different as well. What can you tell us about that?
It's way more introspective. Nick's lyrics were oftentimes about science in relation to humanity. His lyrics were, from what I gathered, because I didn't write any of the lyrics for any of our records, so this is all my take on it. Much more about, you know, how humanity is shitty, which general humanity can be very shitty. I don't like to take that stance and generalize everybody as being shitty, but we can if we want. Casey's lyrics are much more about his experiences, a lot of the stuff he's been through in the last couple years, few people close to him passing away, and kind of that just general loneliness. So it's just a much different look at kind of the same thing, as far as instead of general humanity being shitty, it's kind of like, well, here's the shitty stuff that's happened to me, and kind of his vessel to get it out, which watching a friend be able to get that stuff out of him has been rewarding in that. So if the record did nothing and everybody hated it, it's like, you know what, at least I got to see my friend get a couple years of his life out of his body, in a productive way. So I'd say just kind of listen to it, and you'll totally understand, each story that's told within the eight songs that are on the record.
So on your previous album, Settler, I just recently found out that, it was specifically about Krista McAuliffe, who died in the Challenger disaster. It's kind of a funny connection to me, because when I was in elementary school, I did a book report on Judith Resnick, who was also on the Challenger. Have you ever heard any sort of response from either the family members or anyone like involved in like dealing with the Challenger at all?
No, nothing. Which is odd, because her husband is a judge in my town. And the way we wanted to kind of represent that tragedy was more so that it was a group of people, specifically her, that gave up their lives in an attempt to do something kind of bigger than themselves. So it wasn't in a way to be like, oh, this is so gruesome and brutal and metal. Mm-hmm. It was more of like the beautiful take on that some people in life just, they don't care for themselves whatsoever. And they go into things full well knowing that it could like literally end their lives. But they feel like, you know, they realize the weight that they're taking on, in relation to that. And they realize that it's bigger than their lives. So, you know, they have no choice but to do it. But no, we never got a response from them. Which I think is good. Cause I, you know, my whole time during that was to make it as respectful as possible and definitely not try and use it in any way as to like sell a record or make a shitty point. We didn't want to use any clips of it. We didn't want to do anything like that. We didn't want to use any original photos of them specifically. So it was more of a respectful take. And I think that a lack of response there, probably if they even knew it existed, was probably a good thing actually.
Is there any sort of other historical event or tragedy that maybe you'd like to take a, forgive the word, but stab at writing in the future?
I mean, I feel like a lot of people have taken a stab at kind of reacting to our political situation right now in America. I'd like to attempt to react to that at some point. I don't feel like I'm ready. And I feel like there's a lot of hot takes taken against it right now, without a lot of thought. So I guess, you know, in the future, personally, probably I'd like to take a stab at the results of the 2016 election. But, you know, it's just, we're in a spot right now where one, you don't even know what the hell is true right now. Which is awful because you can't really get any sort of information that isn't immediately said, okay, that's untrue by this source. And then another source comes out and says, well, that guy is, you know, what he said is untrue. So it's like, I feel like any reaction taken right now is just going to sound almost super dated. But I would like to tackle that at some point in the future, maybe when there's more books written about it. But as far as historical things that really hit me a ton, I mean, the Challenger happened when I was probably one of my first memories. And you know, I remember my parents' reaction to it. I was like 5. So I remember my mom crying, and trying to explain to my sister who was older what had happened. And that was why it really struck me, because I had no comprehension of anything. And just watching my mom cry was just like, what the heck? Why is my mom crying? Like, you know, but you know, as far as now, I mean, there's just so much that happens now, and it happens daily. It feels like 2017 has been 8 different years. So, you know, at some point, I definitely try and take a stab at that. But other than that, no, that's just kind of the biggest thing that's weighing on me now, I guess. I think that's weighing on us all, actually.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, you mentioned the books about what's happening. Did you get to check out Shattered, I guess, which is the most recent document about the entire thing? It's great, about the internal failures of like the Hillary Clinton campaign and just how it basically led to crumbling to dust and then having a fucking game show host as the president of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting to me that you have two sides that are both kind of puppets that are propped up by the same hand up their ass. And, you know, one of the sides didn't see the terribleness of the game show host, and they kind of propped up a candidate that I found to be extremely unlikable as a Bernie Sanders supporter. And it was just so weird to me that they attempted to use old methodology to keep propping that up, not realizing that there was a new paradigm happening and that the younger audience is way, way left of the current Democratic Party. And a lot of times they don't even see themselves in it. And still they're calling to go back to the center, which is just, I think they're setting themselves up for another failure. And that to me is like, you want 8 years of this? Like, it's going to be absolutely insane.
Yeah, you spend time on Twitter as well. You've seen the radical center crowd and how insane these people are.
It's absolutely nuts. I mean, you have an entire under 35 class of quote unquote, you know, American liberals now, who I probably, like myself and maybe like you guys, I don't want to ascribe, you know, beliefs to you guys, but you know, who have a core set of beliefs that they want taken care of, that neither side is taken care of. And then you have kind of the baby boomers who just live in a different world almost, that they can't see, you know, how we could get anything we want. So you have two people with just unresolved anger constantly. And like you said, dealing with the general public is everybody's angry. And it's just like, everybody's walking around with a resentment towards somebody, some other general class, whether it be, you know, millennials or whatever. And they just kind of generally take it out on everybody all day, every day. And it's just really creating a real shitty society for everybody to live in. And everybody's walking on eggshells now, and nobody knows where to truly take a stand. And it's just, it's really sad to see that, you know, in my lifetime. I never thought I'd see that, for sure.
Well, in a way, it is, I guess, the acceleration of whatever comes next. And we can hope and we can work at that being next thing being something that benefits the whole.
Yeah, no, and I think our generation will work on that. And I think the generation below us, you know, I have nephews and nieces that are, you know, in sixth and I think eighth grade now. And it's like, I look at them and they have such a great head on their shoulders that it's like, if we can get our generation and their generation together, then you just have to try and plan long term and say, okay, well, within 30 years, we'll try and get healthcare to be in a spot where, you know, people don't have to mortgage we don't even have houses as millennials. So they don't have to like take out a loan to get a broken leg fixed. You know, it's just stuff like that, you know, getting a $20,000 hospital bill for a night stay, like that stuff just has to end. There's no way it's sustainable. Nobody can afford it, you know, and you have hospitals going under. And you just have corporations taking over everything. It's like, if our generation stands for this, I'll be so disappointed in us as a society that, you know, it's like I said, it's maddening. You just walk around with the general resentment towards everybody. We have to have a gigantic shift. And unfortunately, those shifts only happen when you have a driving factor that's generally bad. Like a gigantic 9/11 again, or something like that, where everybody has to stop what they're doing and question what they've been doing. And, you know, you don't want that to happen. And it's sad that something like that has to be a driving force for it. Like, you just want people to kind of take responsibility for themselves and try and make a change. But like we said, there's no simple answer, unfortunately. It's, you know, you can't just say, well, be nice to your neighbor. You know, it's just, that's it. I guess generations before us have led us all down this path, and we're here now, our generation continuing this path or allowing it to happen. And we just can't anymore. It's just not sustainable.
I saw one thing that did brighten my day a few weeks back, and I feel like this might be a good thing to just close it with. But it was essentially, the generation that grew up on Mario Kart is the one that's going to save the world.
You're probably right, and I think that's great. You know, I grew up on Mario Kart, and I think that's, if my generation and your generation saves the world, then more power to us, because the last generation to save the world was the World War II generation. But politically, you don't want to listen to them now, unfortunately. So, so there just needs to be somebody else has to come in and take the reins, and it needs to be young. And it will be the Mario Kart generation. It will be a bunch of princesses and Marios and Luigis.
To be fair, we also grew up with Mortal Kombat, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah. That's true. What was the reptile dude's name?
Reptile. You got it.
Oh, nice. There you go. Yeah, we need a lot of we need more reptilians, that's for sure.
I fully agree. Well, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for listening to my political rant. I appreciate it.
Hell yeah, brother. Thanks for doing it.
Anytime. Thank you, guys. Much appreciated.
Listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.